Hello, and welcome to RCGP Together Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything general practice, brought to you by the RCGP Membership Communities team. I'm Rebecca, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by four GPs who'll be sharing their perspectives on the all-important area of post-traumatic stress disorder. Welcome, everyone, and please introduce yourselves.
Good evening, I'm Amanda Howe. I'm a GP in Norwich. I'm a member of the academic community there at the Medical School, Professor of Primary Care, and I'm the current president of the Royal College of GPs.
I am Robin Simpson. I retired from the Army in January after 35 years service, and I'm presently the Vice Chair of Midlands Faculty, but I'm the RCGP Veterans Champion, promoting NHS GPs in England to understand the need of veterans.
Hi, good evening. My name's Amrita. I'm a portfolio GP with several interests in wellbeing, occupational medicine and physician health. I'm currently the First Five wellbeing lead, and I'm really here to hopefully represent the views of my First Five colleagues.
Hello, everyone. My name's Mike Holmes. I'm a GP partner in Yorkshire and currently the RCGP's Vice Chair for Membership and International. And I've led the RCGP's wellbeing response to COVID, and I chair their wellbeing committee.
Thanks, everyone. Maybe we can start by talking a little bit about what PTSD is and how it might affect GPs. Maybe also a bit about where your expertise and interests fit into that.
I mean, I, as a GP, have been interested in psychological aspects of the consultation since I was a trainee, and I did have some training from counsellors and bailiff groups as part of my training scheme, which was quite unusual. Over the years, that means that I've tended to attract a caseload of patients who perhaps are vulnerable, you know, because I do the things that we all should do about, you know, empathy and asking the right questions and understanding where somebody's coming from and being supportive and empowering where possible to help them to build back and heal. You know, I tend to see patients with aspects of mental health. I also, at one point in research, became very interested in the area which people differently label frequent attenders, multiply unexplained symptoms. And over time, I began to understand that many, many of those people had had significant traumas at some point in their life. Whether as a child, you know, so the common things with PTSD and people, one thing I'm going to say is, guys, read the literature. Not a long thing, but a couple of good briefings about how to diagnose PTSD and the kind of origins that it comes from, because that was a literature that I think is very relevant at the moment, which I'll come back to. But anyway, I gradually began to realise that these sort of people had had a trauma in the past and who were then living with the damage of that, and it hadn't really been intervened with and identified with and helped early enough. So 40 years later, there they still were, perhaps not living the life they could have been. And then actually through the literature from the military, I began to be more aware of the actual diagnosis of PTSD and the criteria that come into that, which again, people can read. But it made me realise that if you identify somebody's had a significant acute traumatic event, you really need to follow that up until you know that they are recovering rather than getting stuck. And that's where early work with people to minimize and prevent PTSD can come in. It has to be the right kind of work, but that's again something I didn't really understand as a GP. But it's changed the way now. So if, you know, say you have a patient who relative commits suicide, or somebody's been in a really horrible accident, or at the moment, you know, being admitted to ITU with COVID, or even lost somebody to COVID, you know, that's got warning bells written all over it. They were powerless. It was unexpected. They couldn't possibly have prepared for it, and life's fallen apart. And often also the other thing is things that people feel shouldn't have happened. That can be a big risk factor as well. So I think that's why at the moment in the college, I've been we've been talking a lot about PTSD literature and why GPs and their teams really need to be alert to that and be putting stuff in place early for colleagues who've had a traumatic time with lots of deaths, unexpected, you know, being in the front line, or indeed patients who've lost loved ones.
So, Amanda, it was interesting to hear that you'd read the literature from the military. Clearly, as a military GP, I've all my time in the military, you know, mental health is top of the list, and PTSD is right up there. And I would like to think that, as a military doctor, I've always looked after PTSD. In 2008, I was asked to go to a British Legion conference. It was one of those things where I was volunteered to go along. I didn't really know what I was doing at the conference. And it was a conference for PTSD sufferers. And there was about a dozen PTSD sufferers who'd been all brought there by the British Legion. They were really angry with me because all of them had a long story of how most of them had served in the Falklands. And yet, the sort of things that they've been exposed to, their boats being blown up, nobody had realized that actually once they left the military, their lives had fallen apart, they'd started drinking, that actually this was PTSD. Partly because they were blokes, they weren't very good at talking about it. But very much when they went to their NHS GP and said they were drinking too much and the wife had left them, or perhaps they were rude because they couldn't get an appointment, it took a long time, and the average length of time for that particular group was about 12 years for the diagnosis of PTSD to be made. And unfortunately, I think once you've had PTSD for that length of time, treatment will help you. It'll help you live with it, but a bit like being alcohol dependent, you're never going to get over it. So these sufferers were really affected by their having been exposed to things in the Falklands. But then they complained about their GPs not recognising it. Mm. Now, I thought we as GPs were all caring and compassionate and we were completely switched on, but every one of them told the same story. So since then, I have been working hard to make NHS GPs more aware of veterans and veterans' health, and asking that very simple question to their patients, have you ever served in the military? Because although Amanda went through the sort of likely symptoms and, you know, if your loved one's just died of COVID, then it's definitely you need to be followed up. Unfortunately, patients don't necessarily present saying, I've got PTSD. They present drinking too much. They present with relationship problems. They present because they haven't got a job. And you have to deal, it's not obvious to make you think of PTSD. So I think that the recognition of PTSD is right up there at the top. Moving on a bit, in 2011, I did a six-month tour in Afghanistan, and it was pretty tough. All the reasons, all the things that you know about Afghanistan, I went through. And, you know, I still think a lot about things that I did in Afghanistan. You know, I can remember, unfortunately, children being blown up. I don't think I've got PTSD, but, you know, it's not a nice memory. And I probably don't watch television programs anymore about Afghanistan because that's my avoidance. I don't think I've got PTSD, but it certainly makes you realize that, you know, war is not a pleasant thing. And yet every soldier, every serviceman that was in Afghanistan will have seen the same things as me, but only a small proportion go on to get PTSD. So it's not quite straightforward. It's not like you'll see something awful and you'll get PTSD. So, you know, in the military, we often recruit people from areas of high unemployment, and maybe they're joining the military to escape from something. And of course, when they leave the military, they might be going back to what they were escaping from, and they've been through something awful in Afghanistan. So in the military, we would like to think that we're switched on, that we look for it. And actually the length of time of diagnosis from PTSD is now, I think, about 3 years, when previously it was 12 years. It's a difficult topic. We haven't gone to treatment yet. But top of my list, top of my agenda is recognizing PTSD. And that's an area that I'm concentrating on. Just asking yourself, why is this person behaving in a funny way? Did you ever serve in the military? He's got some tattoos on his arms. And then suddenly it falls into place. So PTSD isn't the commonest condition that veterans have. But when they do get it, it's really, really difficult to treat. And that's why we must pick it up early.
So I suppose my interest in emotional and psychological welfare of patients has come really from my childhood. And that's having seen my father as a village GP. And he taught me a lot about the way I practice medicine today. And one of the teachings that really have stayed with me is he said, you know, always look at your patient and think about the person who's walking through the door and not the problem. And I know that that's something that we teach people, but he went on to expand on that and say, not just look at them walking through the door, but why are they wearing the shoes that they're wearing? What home have they come from? What are their life circumstances? And I think that's something that I really took into my day-to-day practice, because I was lucky enough to work in a practice where we had quite a lot of military personnel who'd served in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I had a lot of exposure to the difficult circumstances that my patients had faced. And unfortunately, a lot of them had been diagnosed with anxiety disorders and depressive disorders, but not a lot of them had had the question asked, as you just mentioned, Robin, have you served in the military? Have you had any exposure to military life? And what were your previous experiences? And I think even just by asking that one question, we get so much information from people. So socioeconomic background is so important. And I think it's no fault of anybody's, but just in the busy, busy lives that we lead as GPs, sometimes we forget to ask the very basic questions. And that's so important, because it can give us such an important picture about who it is who's sitting in front of us and why they've come through the door today. And I think that is why PTSD is so important to me, because for me, I'm now studying a master's in applied positive psychology and coaching psychology. So well-being to me isn't a separate aspect of the human body and the human mind. It's so much part of us, and it's why we behave the way we behave. It's why we have the emotions that we have. It's why our physical health is the way that it is. It's so much a part of our own selves and our own mental health, our physical health. And we really need to be proactive about how we look after our own selves and our patients rather than reactive. And I think that's something that we maybe aren't as good at. So having a more proactive approach and really imbibing and building in the emotional and psychological therapies at an early stage, as you just said as well, Robin, because if we get to the root of the problems at an earlier stage, we can actually be reparative rather than therapeutic.
So I guess my perspective is slightly different, in that I see myself first and foremost as a jobbing GP. I don't have any specific mental health training other than what I receive as a GP. And so I guess for me, it's about coming at it from that perspective, you know, recognizing that PTSD may be something that we see more of in the wake of COVID, and just really trying to refresh my own knowledge. I'm also a partner in a large practice and have over 200 employees. So I've got a responsibility to them to support training, to raise awareness of PTSD and other mental health consequences of the period that we're going through. And potentially also really try to support people to focus on their own well-being. And perhaps we'll come back to that a little bit later. We're also a veterans practice, part of the RCGP program, which I think has been a fantastic program. Coincidentally, two of my partners are veterans themselves and have seen active conflict around the world in Bosnia, the Gulf, Afghanistan. And talking to them, you recognize the importance of this condition and the impact it can have on people's lives. And so I think we're quite aware of that. And we understand that potentially COVID will have a similar impact. I've been very fortunate to be part of the Health and Wellbeing Response Task Force that's been set up by NHS England through my role at the college. And as part of that, I've been really privileged to speak to a number of experts, Professor Neil Greenberg, who's a military expert in this area, and heard him speak and heard him, you know, very passionately articulate the importance of PTSD during and beyond the pandemic. And that's really helped us put together some of the resources that we're thinking around at the RCGP. And of course, we have Jonathan Leach, who has worked very closely with Robin, who has a real interest in this area. And we've put together some resources on our COVID response hub. I'd really recommend them to you. You know, there's a 10-minute screencast, change your practice screencast on PTSD and the impact of lockdown that's really digestible and could be really helpful. The other part of my role at the college is the international work of the college. And I've been in contact with GPs from across Europe, and more latterly GPs from Italy, where the pandemic hit really quite hard and slightly ahead of our experience in the UK. And we're now starting to see the impact of the pandemic on their mental health, and in particular, an increase in the incidence of PTSD, which perhaps gives us a little bit of insight into what might happen in the UK. So I think that's where my interest lies, not a specialist interest, but certainly as a GP, as an employer, and as someone in the college who's focusing on wellbeing.
How did you become aware of this area of work, and how does it interact with your day-to-day practice as a GP?
As a GP, that breadth that particularly Amrita was talking about earlier has been my basis. And I've often not wanted to over-medicalise things. You know, we can clearly see the societal causes of some psychological problems. Not all, you know, I'm not going to talk about some of the major psychoses and, you know, perhaps genetic causes, all sorts of different epidemiologies. But for many, many people, the reason that they are psychologically vulnerable is because of things that have happened in the past, whether it be, you know, they've been in the military, or they were raped when they were younger, or they saw their mother killed in a road accident, or whatever. You know, those things stick with people and can damage them. And so I think for a long time I resisted some of the mental health diagnostic categories. Sorry, RC Psych, but there was that little bit of me that didn't want to hear things labelled as a mental illness because I thought it was over-medicalisation. And as I've grown up a little bit and realised that you still have to be able to make sense of things and have a set of diagnostic criteria and know what it means, and that means you know some of the ways to intervene, I've become more comfortable with things like the diagnosis of PTSD. And then, as I said, you know, it's become more and more obvious that it is incredibly relevant with special risk groups like veterans and so on. But I also have become more interested in what you can do early that may, and I mean really early, like when you know people have been at risk, not 3 years rather than 12 years, but, you know, this month, next month, the month after. And looking back at the literature, because of the sense in the COVID environment that many people are being traumatized, and we may hit a big wall of psychological problems among staff, among patients, as we go into the next phase. So I think day to day, it's actually as much about what we're already putting in place and also showing people that, you know, there's been all the stuff on the web about mindfulness, well-being, relaxation, get home, don't watch the news again, you know, walk around your garden, do some online yoga, whatever you can get out and do that's going to take your mind into another better place, give you the message, I'm looking after myself now.
It's important that if you drive along the motorway and you see a terrible car accident and someone dies, you're going to be affected by it. And that's a normal reaction. You know, if you deal with a terrible thing in the practice, certifying someone dead, then it is going to affect you. And I think, as Amanda was saying, you know, that's to be expected. And in the military, you mentioned Professor Neil Greenberg, but one of the things that he did was he brought a thing called TRIM, trauma risk management, to the military. So when patrols in Afghanistan came back, it wasn't a medical input, but basically they sat down and it was slightly structured in that they would have a cup of tea or a coffee and they would discuss what had happened on patrol. And there was some evidence that's a helpful approach. Now, translating that into the practice, you know, I think it's about sitting down with our practice members when they've been through something and just talking it through, and you know, recognizing that you are allowed to feel tearful after you've seen something not very nice, or you've had to certify a death, or you know, your most favorite patient's just got COVID. You know, it's going to be upsetting. So, you know, when we're all busy, are we good at sitting down and having time talking to our colleagues, telling each other how we feel, and telling us it's okay to feel a bit anxious? I think when we're busy, when our doors are shut, it's easy to forget about it. So, you know, very much we're part of teams. Now, I'm not saying that in NHS practice we should all go through trauma risk management and formal debriefs, but I think that it's a bit more than a cup of tea. It's just about listening and allowing our colleagues and friends to talk things through. And then also noticing if after a few weeks they're still talking about them. So, you know, that terrible accident that you've seen on the motorway, you know, that's going to affect you for a few weeks. But, you know, a month later, you might still remember it when you drive past the spot. But, you know, you can carry on. It's still there, but it's not a difficulty. Now, if you're going to have a mental health problem that is going to scar you, you're still going to be thinking about it. You're going to be getting the flashbacks. And you also probably will be embarrassed. You know, maybe, you know, I think Prince William and Prince Harry have done a fantastic job in lowering the stigma of mental health, particularly among blokes. You know, blokes are completely hopeless at talking about these things, which is one of the reasons that men overall get more PTSD, perhaps, or there is a debate around that. But, you know, talking about what we've been through and sharing our experiences and telling our colleagues it's okay to have a bit of a tear, then that's absolutely fine. What I've found with my patients over the last couple of months is those that have existing mental health problems are definitely easily damaged. So they're definitely people that are more vulnerable. And you'll know your staff well in practices. We work in teams. You'll know that they've been through things. And if something awful happens to them or to all of us in the practice, then there are particular people that you need to watch out. So, you know, I think that we have to accept that we, during the COVID epidemic, we're all going to see terrible things. And it's normal to feel anxious and apprehensive and worried and question yourself and lose your confidence. That's a sort of normal reaction, and you can move on. But if it's troubling you and you're not sleeping and you're getting flashbacks, then you really do need professional help. So look out for your team members. Sit down, spend some time. You know, if at the end of the day you've had a whole day as a GP and you haven't sat down with a member of your staff, you know, we can't function as GPs without our teams, and that requires you to spend time with them and looking after them and looking after each other. And I think that's definitely something that we could do better at.
So part of what I do is I work as a coach as well. And when you work in a field such as that, you have protective time, which is supervision. And that's how you learn. And that's how you understand and become a better coach. And you learn about your clients and you learn about your own self and your own emotional behaviours, your own psychology. And that's something that we just lack completely in medicine, apart from in the field of psychiatry. And I really support what you were saying, Robin, about bringing debriefs in. Essentially, I've always been interested in the mind-body connection. And that really, I have to acknowledge, has come from my heritage and has come from the fact that I feel that my spirituality has allowed me to realize that actually our mental health, our physical health, our emotional health, our psychological health are all part of the same thing. And therefore, if we are going to have a reaction to an event such as traumatic events, it's not just going to affect our mental health, but it's going to affect our physical health as well. And we see that in our patients. We see that in ourselves when people have either acute stress disorder or they have post-traumatic stress disorder or post-traumatic stress injury, however you want to label it. And I don't really like using labels, so I want to try to move away from that. But however you want to define the symptoms, we see that not only do people have these emotional responses, they have negative mood, they have the psychological responses of avoidance, intrusion, hyper-arousal, but they also have the physical health aspects of increased sympathetic nerve stimulation. So they have an increased risk of cardiovascular symptoms as well. So for me, I try not to look at it as a single entity. I look at it as the whole person. And that really is where my interest lies and how I became aware of this work. I agree that there are people who, unfortunately, because of their life circumstances, are going to be more at risk of these unfortunate conditions. And we can't help that. But what we can do is try to educate people and try to build a more reparative state, change the narrative, change the language that we're using so that people are more open to discussing the difficulties that they're having. And I think by doing that, by just everybody becoming a bit more accepting of the language that we use, slowly, slowly changes the culture. And when we change the culture, we allow acceptance to filter into not only our own personal lives, but our professional lives, our teams, and it allows people to be able to be comfortable with the emotions that they're feeling. They become able to become aware of the emotions they're feeling, because as doctors as well, we're very used to having to deal with things in the moment because we have to. We can't carry on with our jobs if we don't do that. We wouldn't be very, very good at our jobs if we didn't put things to the side and deal with them later. But the problem with doing that on a repeated basis is that it becomes a reaction. It just becomes an automation. We put them to the side and we don't actually deal with them later. And we need to start bringing those emotions back to the forefront of our mind and making it acceptable to deal with them. And I think exactly what Robin was saying, having these team debriefs, having these discussions, having an open space where people can just have a space to talk. They might not want to talk, but just giving somebody that opportunity, I think, is hugely valuable. Unfortunately, at the beginning of COVID, as a portfolio GP, I work as a locum, and I found that obviously in the rate of which things were changing, everybody had cancelled their annual leave. So there was very, very little work out there for locums. So quite a lot of the changes that were happening was that locums were working in the 111 hubs, in the what we were calling dirty hubs at the time, and were working in the urgent care centres. And there's a vast proportion of locums who do that type of work, but there's also a vast proportion of locums who do not do that type of work for whatever circumstances. And we have to understand that locums do not just locum for financial reasons. They might locum for caring reasons. They might locum because they have physical health or mental health ailments. So working in those types of, or other reasons, that there are lots of other caveats. I'm sorry, I haven't named them all. But working in those types of environments might not have suited them. So therefore, we have a large proportion of the workforce who are not being utilised in the most helpful way. And then you have a large proportion of the workforce who are being utilised in these different arenas. And so what I just want to bring to the forefront is, how are we supporting these colleagues? Because these colleagues aren't part of teams. These colleagues aren't part of team huddles for us to start thinking about our locum wider community, because I know that there are people out there who are working very, very hard who we need to look after as well.
So I'm going to focus on how it impacts on my day-to-day work as a GP. And I think, I guess the first thing that has happened over recent months is that my awareness of this is a possibility in terms of what someone might walk into my surgery suffering with has heightened. And I think the same is true of my colleagues. The more we talk about this, I can sense that my colleagues recognize that this is something we should be looking out for. And I think as you start to read about it, you recognise that this is not uncommon. And, you know, having spoken to some military colleagues, it can be, you know, if you look at military colleagues returning from active service, it can be as high as, and Robin might correct me here, but I gather it's sort of high teens, 17, 18% of people might suffer with some form of PTSD. And amongst doctors, hospital doctors, emergency doctors, that figure is somewhere in the region of 12%. I haven't seen any figures for general practice, but there's no reason to suspect it may not be in a similar sort of ballpark. So this is, you know, it is a reality out there that we need to be aware of. And I think my reading has, made me aware that giving patients time, giving them space to talk about this is really important. Understanding the options we have for them, understanding that actually, many people will recover from this, as I think Robin alluded to. without any sort of intervention, just time and space and access to you as a GP. But also, you know, what the role of CBT and other psychological therapies might be and how do we access them? You know, as a GP, find out about that. Find out what's available locally and know what to do. Know the role of medication. I think, you know, many medications that perhaps are to be avoided, certainly alcohol to be avoided, benzodiazepines to be avoided. But there may be a role for SSRIs in the treatment of PTSD. And certainly there's a role for referral if we think we need to use other medications. So I think that's how it's impacted on me. It's in terms of educating myself, refreshing my knowledge, increased awareness of who might walk through my door suffering from this. But I think the main impact has been how I help people to maybe try and look after themselves and raise awareness of the importance of that. And we've heard from all three of our colleagues on the podcast about that. So how do we make well-being proactive and positive and not something that's reactive and maybe an afterthought and something that we're thinking about when someone's already unwell? It's how we get it further up the agenda, really. In my practice, we're talking about well-being windows. So actually giving staff paid time, 30 minutes a week, to think about their own well-being, to access some of the self-help resources that are available to us, to talk to colleagues about it. We're raising the acceptability of considering well-being. Robin talked about how men are perhaps not good at talking about this sort of stuff. So let's make it part of our normal. Let's raise the profile. Let's empower people to talk about it. And I know one of the things that has been talked about in the Recovery Commission is about how do we change the culture of the NHS so well-being is embedded as something that's normal. And I'm really interested in how we do that. I hear talk of it being part of appraisal in the future, and I personally really, really welcome that. So I think, and the other thing I've heard about is this concept of debriefing after surgeries. One of the things that we've tried locally is something called the 20-minute care space that Charlie Jones, who's a psychologist down in Bristol, started doing it with emergency department staff. And it is very quick. It's a 20-minute group session, which can be done. You need a facilitator to do it, somebody who's used to holding that psychological space. But it allows people to articulate what's on their mind, what's worrying them, what's causing them stress, but then also to talk about practical things that they might do. What do they need to change in their lives? Listen to others articulating similar things, learning from them, and then taking positive action. And that's certainly been... it's very early days with it, and I think it's still being evaluated, but it's something I've taken part in a few times now, and I've found it very helpful.
So looking at this through the lens of COVID, what impact is the pandemic having on your own personal mental health, on the mental health of GPs, other practice staff, etc., and how can we proactively protect our mental health during these times, whilst some of the go-to options for looking after our well-being might not be readily available to us?
Personally, the thing that's really, really striking is uncontrolled change in my life. So a lot of things that I thought I'd be doing in this period aren't happening, and they're not going to happen. You know, the effect on my mental health is I'm okay. And so you said, so, you know, what do we do given that we haven't got some of the escape routes? Well, coming home and going for a bike ride, I mean, at least it's been lovely weather. I've been really good about making sure I have exercise every day. I've been doing a lot of cooking. I've been looking at some stuff. So I think, you know, again, it's the things I'd be saying to my patients. I've now been saying them to myself, you know.
Working as a GP, I really miss seeing my patients, and not having them sitting next to you is very different. It's very odd. On the other hand, there are definitely some patients that are actually better on the phone and better at talking, so it does give opportunities, but I definitely miss seeing patients. I have consulted on the video before, but not like half my patients. And so, you know, it is a bit of a relearning process, videoing patients, and you definitely concentrate on the patients, but you're also looking at the mantelpiece and wondering what else is going on. So, you know, I've had to change my consulting round about the video. And I saw a little film that Roger Neighbor put on at the very beginning about, you know, really sensible things like, where's the camera and are you looking at it? And I know it seemed pretty blindingly obvious, but I found Roger's really helpful. Amanda said that, you know, she's good with her exercise. And one of the things that I've learned is when I've been really, really busy and knackered, it's very easy to say, stuff it and not go and do the exercise. So I think there's a personal discipline. And I'm good at getting up early and I do exercise before I go to work. And I've always done that. And I find that really helpful. I'm not very good at going to bed early as well. And I'm terrible at doing my emails late at night. So definitely not perfect. I think as a GP, I love my work. And of course, we're there to support our patients. And that's, you know, our overwhelming desire to do what's best for our patients definitely keeps you going. There's a lot of frustrations. And of course, deaths and some awful things happening are bad. But the administration around hospitals, you know, I referred a patient to hospital 3 weeks ago and the casualty had closed the day before. So dealing with the admin and dealing with the different forms, I found that really quite frustrating. And actually dealing with the patients is very easy. But we certainly, it changes every single day. And I found that quite difficult. Is there more mental health around? I think that the patients haven't displayed new mental health. You know, I've got patients whose mental health has been exasperated, but I do think there are people sitting at home that haven't come to see us that will come and see us when things change. So, you know, I think our antenna need to be up. I need a mental health questions and open questions and exploring patients' agenda are going to be really, really important, particularly for those patients that have avoided us during COVID. It's been different. I've definitely changed. You know, it was quite stressful the first few weeks. Now I've gotten to my routine. There's some aspects of this new routine that I quite like. Commuting to work with no traffic is amazing.
I guess for me, my personal challenges, I mean, let's start with family. I got my wife's business is in event management, so that's not happening. Mass events is not happening, so she's kind of not been working too much, and that proves, you know, that creates challenges. My kids are a bit older than Amy's kids, so one's in the year before GCSEs and one's in the year before A-levels, so they've got stresses now, you know, schooling from home, and so there's a whole lot of adaptation and changes that goes on around you. And I guess like many of us, we work pretty hard, don't we? You know, we're already busy. Before COVID, you feel like you're as busy as you can be, and then COVID comes along and everything gets busier. So that was the sort of impact on me to begin with, that, okay, how am I going to cope with all of these things that are suddenly much busier than they used to be? And I guess for a little while at the beginning, I was working 7 days a week. You know, you feel that that's important and this is a crisis and you've got to be there and you've got to do these things. And you know, and that was fine. It felt like the right thing to do. And did it affect me? I don't know. I think my sleep patterns probably weren't brilliant for a little while. It's you know, looking back, I think it definitely had an impact. What did I try to do? I mean, I try and exercise a bit anyway, but that, you know, I've certainly focused on that. My dog's been walked more than he's ever been walked in his life, so he's enjoying the fitness benefits of it. I've done a bit of decorating. I'd normally stay away from that, you know, at all costs, but I've kind of embraced that and actually quite enjoyed it. And at the practice, we've done this thing called a Strava challenge, and it's got everybody involved. The other thing is connecting with friends and family. So, you know, who would have thought it? We've kind of, as a profession, been a little bit kind of reluctant with videos and remote communication. But boy, have we embraced it during this, and I think it's been really good, you know, professionally and from a family perspective. Amanda will tell you I quite like innovation and change, and actually, to be able to do some of that rapidly has actually been quite a buzz for me. I think I've really enjoyed it. And I think some of it will stay. But like Robin, I recognize some of it, you know, we need to reconnect with our patients, and face-to-face consultations are so central to what we do. We need to work hard to make sure we find the place for them alongside the innovation. The staff have had challenges, our colleagues and staff in the practices, you know, I think they've been really organised. They've been superb in how they've responded to this. I've seen really, it's better team working than I've ever seen before in some cases. But of course, they've been risk stratified. You know, we're trying to protect them and use tools to stratify their personal risk. And some are seeing patients in hot sites and some just in cold sites and some not seeing patients at all. And I think what that does, it for me, it kind of really made me understood our vulnerability and our, and that we're all human, actually, you know. And I think that's it's good to think about that now and again. And in terms of patients, we've tried to communicate with them as best as we can. You know, we've started texting them. We've done some text surveys and had a phenomenal response, like 5,000 responses to a text survey about exercise habits amongst patients. And they're exercising more, according to our survey, anyway. We put videos on our website. We've used social media. We've tried to do radio shows and try and just connect with the population. And I think, you know, the thing that Robin talked about is right. You know, we've seen a 50% reduction in referrals to our IAP service locally. And that's a worry, I think. I think there's clearly people not presenting with problems, particularly mental illness type problems. And I worry about how that's going to present in the future and how general practice can and will respond to that. So it's been a journey, hasn't it? And I think the reality is it's not over yet. We've still got some way to go on this journey. And I think focusing on how we cope with it proactively, it ought to be a priority for us.
I guess the final question here is what takeaway you would have for other GPs or practices to put into action. And maybe Amanda, Mike, you could possibly talk a bit about what the college is doing and can provide in that sphere.
So I think my take homes are that there's already a lot of important knowledge about what works. And we probably don't need to add too much more to that. We just need to capture it and translate it into this world, particularly acknowledging the risk of negative reaction. You can call it burnout, you can call it denial, but after you've had a loss, anger is normal, isn't it? That's what they teach us in the literature, anger as well as grief. And I think we've got to be very alert as professionals, both individuals and in our organizations, that when things lash back, we've got to find ways of not accepting that, because that would be bullying, but not overreacting to it either, because there's going to be times when people do, you know, express anger. So I think being psychologically intelligent as well as, you know, sensitive is going to be important. And I think certainly having organizational strategies based on the knowledge we already have that we commit to and that we then stick to when the going gets tough, as well as principles for ourselves.
I think that as a college, we've always been very proud of the way that we look after our trainees. And clearly we need to look after ourselves and our teams as we come out of this, come out of lockdown. But we absolutely need to put our energy into making sure that we remember our trainees. We'll have to adjust the curriculum. General practice has changed considerably. We've talked about the videos, we've talked about audios. So the way that we train our GP trainees is going to have to change accordingly. But things have changed. So how are we going to continue to make general practice an exciting career?
I think, as you all probably guess, my answer is going to be about wellbeing, because this is something I'm hugely passionate about, but not just on an individual level, on a structural level, on an organisational level as well. And I don't just mean self-care, because for me, self-care is in the moment, looking after yourself if you've had a bad day or you've had a bad experience. I'm talking about holistic, longitudinal well-being that's so imbibed in your life that it's part of your everyday living. It's part of your organisational culture. It's part of our structure as the NHS, because we have to be awake to the fact that the cultures within the NHS need some shift. There needs to be some movement of what's been happening. And I think this COVID crisis, if there is going to be anything to come out of this COVID crisis, it's this beautiful teamwork and this beautiful regalvanization of energy that has come out of it, because we all want to work together to support, to work for a greater good and cause. And I think we can really harness this energy to propel ourselves forward.
So what has the college done during COVID? Well, we've produced our resource hub, which I think is a phenomenal resource. And we know that the number of people accessing that has increased significantly. We have a wellbeing hub as part of that, and a members forum as part of that, which Amanda's been really instrumental in. And it's got people talking, it's got people communicating, it's got people visiting our digital space. And I think that's really important, as I suspect that digital presence is going to be really prominent in the future of the college. In terms of specifics, our wellbeing site is supporting people to look after themselves, to look at their lifestyle. We've talked a little bit about that already, so I won't dwell on it here. It's also talking about what can happen in practices and signposting to resources that practices can do to help their employees and their colleagues. But it's also signposting to external resources. And there's been a lot produced. And some of it the college has been close to. So I've found the real privilege of working alongside some of NHS England's team to develop their coaching service called #LookingAfterYouToo. And that's had a really good launch. And that's available to everybody in primary care in England. But I know that in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, there are similar wellbeing offers. But that's had huge uptake. And I think, again, that recognises that the stresses felt in frontline general practice is not just with GPs. It's the whole primary care team, clinical and non-clinical. And so if you look at our website, there's a huge amount of effort and work being put into it by the team from a wellbeing perspective. So looking after yourself, wellbeing and work, there's a whole raft of online events and recordings, videos, podcasts. We've got our campaign, which is #RCGPTogether, encouraging people to communicate from the front line, post photos, post messages. And that camaraderie amongst GPs is also really important. My take-home message, I think well-being needs to be viewed as something that we address proactively and positively. Talking about well-being, embracing vulnerabilities are definitely not a weakness. They're an absolute strength. And if we do it right, we'll be better doctors, we'll feel better about ourselves, and we'll do a better job for our patients.
Huge thanks to all of our speakers this week. Find out more information about their work, as well as links to the resources mentioned in the conversation, in the show notes below this episode. If you have experience in PTSD in general practice, what have you learned from your experience, and what would you share with your colleagues? Tweet us at Team GP and let us know to start the conversation. That's all for now. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.